Today's episode of Tech Talks on the Unsettled Media Podcast Network is brought to you by Tech Impact, focused on unlocking prosperity by embracing technology. For more, head to techimpact.it.
Welcome to today's episode of Tech Talks with Kathy Simpson. You know, when I sit back and think about what we're trying to do on this podcast, it really is about storytelling. Maybe it's not that children's storybook that comes to mind, like Goldilocks and the Three Bears or Harry Potter. When you hear the word storytelling, that might be the image that it conjures up. Well, on the podcast, we hope our work is about telling stories that will inspire a next generation of talent to study in Atlantic Canada. We hope to help inform a newcomer to learn more about what's happening here and the opportunities and support system that exists. What else do we hope for? Well, we hope through our stories that an investor will hear about an ecosystem that's producing talent with great ideas and that they need to learn more. For the startup, perhaps it's to learn more about investing. And for a business owner, perhaps it's about getting insights into the type of technology that could be helpful for that problem that they have that needs to be solved in a more efficient and effective way. We've been tackling all of these types of storylines on the podcast, and we sure hope you continue to enjoy our stories as much as we enjoy telling them and producing them. Well, today joining me is Eric Cook. He is a thought leader, a CEO, and he runs an organization called RPC. RPC is New Brunswick's provincial research organization, a research and technology group offering contract R&D and technical services. Eric describes their goal to be on the leading edge, but not the bleeding edge of what they do. Quality is essential, and at their core, they work with clients who have ideas, and they help apply science to create value. That's innovation. Last year, they worked with over 1,300 unique clients. They are collaborators on many, many innovative solutions. And he talks about that in this week's episode. We'll also talk about what it takes to develop a focus on productivity. It's so essential right now and as we look ahead for our economy. So let's dive in and learn a whole lot more from Eric. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. I'm thrilled to have Eric Cook from RPC with us today for our show. And we're going to talk about productivity. And there's a lot to talk about when it comes to productivity. So, Eric, thanks for joining me on the show today.
It's my pleasure to be here, Kathy.
So tell us a little bit about where did you study? What did you study? I know you're an engineer and been to a couple of schools or so. So tell us a little bit about your background, Eric.
Sure. I ended up studying engineering. I guess early on, I grew up in Prince Edward Island and loaded potato trucks as a kid. And I got promoted to grease monkey in the trucks and got interested in mechanical stuff and ended up having an interest in mechanical engineering. So I started at UPEI. They have a diploma program. They've since started degree granting in engineering in one discipline anyway. But in the years I was going, I had to transfer to either UNB or TUNS. I chose UNB and completed my mechanical engineering here in Fredericton. Later on, and I did some interesting, I had some very good career experience, but it wasn't very long before I realized I preferred managing technology more so than doing it. I went back to school a little later to UDM and did an MBA. And since that time, I've been overseeing technology, but not necessarily been hands-on with it.
So that was a bold move to go do your MBA in French?
Well, actually, I didn't. It looks that way, but I was the first Anglophone graduating class at the time. Yes. And the time in Moncton, I was working in Moncton at the time at ComDev. And at the time, there was a lot of pent-up demand for an MBA program. And Queen's was looking to do a video conference there. And UMB was even taking a look at coming up and offering a course in Moncton. And UDM stepped forward and offered an MBA program. And it was exceptional because of the quality of people that came forward and participated. Like most programs that are, have experienced people attending them, it's the classmates that are the most interesting. And you can learn as much from the classmates as the instructors, I guess, to be kind. And I really enjoyed meeting some of the people, learning what they were doing in Moncton at the time. And I got quite a lot out of it. I enjoyed the program.
How long did it take for you to decide that you wanted to be the manager versus the doing of the mechanical engineering work?
Yeah, not very long. I started, my very first job was with Technology Transfer Center at UNB called the Manufacturing Technology Center. And we were doing some work in CAD-CAM, which was leading edge at the time. And we got some, the program we were using was a package called Unigraphics, which at the time was launched by McDonnell Douglas Aircraft Company. And UMB actually got the software on an ITB, an industrial and technological benefit. And big aerospace companies and automotive companies and companies like Alcan were using the software. And we got contracts with those companies. A prime customer was Spar Aerospace, who were working on the Canada arm at the time. And I got working on that. Wasn't very long, but I think it was about 2 years into it that the director of the center left to do her PhD, and I was made acting director. And I quickly realized that I liked that role, and I guess that's where it first started.
And you have been working, though, in the technology and engineering space your entire career. So what is it about building things, breaking things, fixing things? What is it about that space that gets you excited?
I think being on what I'll call the leading edge, not, avoiding the bleeding edge, but being on the leading edge and seeing science and technology applied and generating value. And that's really what gets my blood going. My time that I was working in the space sector, what I really loved about that sector is the value proposition. The consumer, you know, as we know, makes her decision based on price, delivery, and quality, normally almost in that order. In the space world, it's flipped around. It's, you have to have the quality or you're not even eligible. You have to have the delivery. You have to have it available when they want it or need it for their launch, or you're not on the table. Then they haggle over price. And as a technical person, that's the ideal value proposition. You're just kind of programmed to make things the best they can be. And it's frustrating when that's not the mandate. So the only other sector that I've spent some time around that is like that I've experienced is the nuclear energy sector, where you absolutely have to have quality and delivery front of mind for delivering on that. So those are things that interest me. It's, you know, just recent in the news, seeing all the Mars exploration work with three instruments hitting Mars. I had a chance to work on an instrument that went to Mars back in 93, 94. I was working on it, and it's just phenomenal. The amount of diverse skill sets to make a project like that come together, the pushing things to their absolute limits as far as technical capabilities, just the thrill when you see it all come together, and it's exciting area to be in.
So if you think about that quality and delivery, you've spent a good portion of your career at RPC, And when you have a look at the RPC website, you really get a sense of science, delivery, huge volumes of work. You have a huge staff there now doing a wide variety of products. So tell us a little bit about RPC for those listeners who may not know even what the acronym stands for.
Sure thing. Yeah, and I like that you immediately sense the science and the quality aspect. And that's really part of what attracts me to RPC. Quality is absolutely essential here. So let me back up and answer your question. The RPC was formed in 1962. We're in a category of organizations called a research and technology organization. And RTOs specialize in the translational aspects of innovation, moving things from the lab into industry to realize economic value. And that's really what innovation is. Often you hear innovation misused because of something being creative or some new discovery that gets referred to as innovation. Until that's translated into economic or social value, it's not yet innovation. And that's where RPC specializes. So we often work with clients who have ideas or an opportunity or a problem and help apply science to get it translated into value for the client. We are diverse. It's part of our strength. It can be a weakness, especially when it comes to marketing or services, because we do a lot of work in the nuclear energy sector, and then somebody comes to drop their water sample off and they say, oh, I'm in the wrong place. No, you're in the right place. We do that too. But really a way to think about our organization is most of what we do fits in one of two categories, an analytical service. That's the type of thing that's repeated. It can be, we can quote you a price on it because it's the same type of a process every time. And those are usually to some type of an accredited standard. And we test everything from, I mentioned, water, soil, radon gas, through to cannabis is a hot topic lately. And then the second category of service would be an applied science, something that is... has an application where we're going often into the customer's site and making something work for them. It's not just delivering a report. It's building things and delivering things, whether it be a process or a product that works for the client and solves a problem or pursues an opportunity for them.
So say I'm a farmer, small, medium, or large, and I've got some problems with the crop, or I've got problems with equipment, or I want to try something new to improve my productivity, but I can't quite figure it out. Can I come knocking on your door?
Yes, you sure can. Though there's not many people we turn away. If we can't help, we often, because we've been around for a long time, know somebody who can. But we've tackled just exactly that type of scenario, working with it happened to be a community in Prince Edward Island who were looking to harvest strawberries. And we did some work on the processing and the harvesting side of things. Of course, McCain was an early customer. Harrison McCain was on our first board of directors in 1962. They have remained a customer ever since our inception. And we do a lot of work for McCain's, mostly on the food processing side of things, less so on the agricultural side, although we have done a number of agricultural projects for them, mostly process engineering, helping them develop new processes.
So when you talk about economic and social value, could you help me get my idea to a product stage where I'm actually applying for a patent for what I built? Are you part of that process, perhaps?
Yes, we are. We have our name on a whole number of patents, but we're usually listed as a co-inventor, not an owner. And that's part of our public good. We're a provincial crown corporation, and we're a not-for-profit. So we work to recover our costs, but unlike a for-profit company, we're not trying to take an IP position in your idea. And that makes us very business-friendly. So so we have, if you come to me with an idea and there's a original thinking in there that's patentable, We will help you. We often prepare patent packages to submit to the patent lawyers to apply. And we may be listed as a co-inventor, but you would be the owner of that patent.
Tell me about the types of skills and people that work at RPC, because you've got labs in multiple cities and locations, and I'm trying to imagine someone and the depth of skill and talent you've got in these various teams. So give us a bit of an insight at what you might find at RPC.
Sure. As you've suggested, it's quite a cross-section of people. So we have three sites. Our main site is in Fredericton, where the majority of our staff are located. But we also have a site in St. George, New Brunswick. That site is a fish health lab serving the aquaculture sector. And a site in Moncton, which is a brand new lab. We haven't had the official opening, but we're waiting until COVID conditions allow for it. But that lab mostly now tests water, but we're working on launching new services up there. So the Fredericton site has the most diversity and the most people. I think there's about 160 on the site here, 160 employees. And there's engineers, all types of engineers, mechanical, electrical, software engineers, and scientists, which include strong preference for chemistry, but also biology, molecular biologists, microbiologists, and then supporting staff. So we have staff for safety and quality and administration, financial, and so on. But we probably the single biggest category that we've been hiring in lately would be chemists. We take a lot of chemists, particularly out of UMB's program, but other programs around Canada and some international. We have, I meant to look this up before we talked, Kathy, but I think there's at least 17 nations represented at RPC that have come.
That's fantastic. Yeah. And what's driving all the chemists?
Well, there's a lot of chemistry. Chemists will give you a biased view and tell you that chemists rule the world. I'm not sure if I would buy into that, but I certainly do when I have a chemist in front of me. Chemistry is a really strong area. The analytical side of things is driving a lot of chemist needs. So any kind of food product and food safety usually ends up with either biology or chemistry. The cannabis sector has driven a lot of chemistry for testing for characteristics that you want to see in the cannabis, but also things that you don't want to see, contaminants and so on. The environmental sector, any project you go to do that, whether it be a mining project or a road or pipeline or whatever, there's environmental impact assessments. Those assessments end up in chemistry samples having to be done. So it's a hot area. There's not really a lot of people in that particular sector in Atlantic Canada, and RPC has been there for a long time. It's been a strength of ours right out of the gate, and it remains a strength today.
So if I'm thinking about a career and I'm a chemist or I'm an engineer of the various sorts or I'm a scientist, I typically think of research. I'm going back to that traditional stereotype. And part of what we're trying to do in the podcast is eliminate some of those stereotypes that aren't really real. So if I'm thinking about a career at RPC, talk to me about, sure, you might be doing research, but you're touching a lot of customers on a daily basis.
Yeah, thank you for that. We certainly are. Last year, we served 1,300 unique clients. Now, some of those clients were small projects, multiple, several hundred dollars, let's say, through to a large project for us would be, a few hundred thousand dollars. So we do hire research people. We have a number of PhDs, masters, and bachelor level people. But the people that thrive at RPC and the people that we look for are the folks that want to see it applied. So when we have a PhD that wants to see their work result in a new product or a new process or something that for a client, which can be intense because the clients have schedules and they expect deliveries and it can be intimidating. But when we see people that gets their blood flowing, we know they're the right kind of people for RPC. So we definitely have research type of functions here, but it's very applied. And it tends to be less of the discovery type of or curiosity-driven research that you would see in an academic community.
And how come you've been able to be successful at getting this diversity? You said 17 different countries, which is amazing. How have you been successful at bringing that diversity to RPC? And how do you keep that? Because it builds such a rich culture in your organization. And is that what you find? How do you do that?
Well, it's a complex answer to that.
It is.
When we are interviewing candidates, we make sure they understand our culture here. It's highly applied. Our paychecks depend on a happy client who pays their bill. And it really sets the culture for our organization. And if you can't stand that pressure or you find that too stressful, this probably isn't the right environment for you. And so we try to communicate that up front. And there's a certain number of people that, and I'm not saying this in a critical way, that aren't happy, you know, writing a paper or having a great discovery or getting a publication in Nature. That's all wonderful, and I thoroughly respect the people that do that. But there's a certain group of people that want to see a customer using that what they developed, and they want to see that application. And those people thrive. So to answer your question in a short form, I think you touched on it with the culture, the type of culture we have here, the type of culture where, you know, if a customer calls at 11 o'clock on a Friday night, you might, depending on what you're doing, you might get called out to do work. That we actually do have, you know, for example, a year ago when the Minto fire was going on, we had our labs running all through, you know, Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. That's the type of environment that we're in. When a customer has an urgent need, we have to respond. And if that's what you like, this is the right place for you. And so when people come and they have the right idea of what the culture is and the expectation is, and they have some success with that, they tend to stick around. Not all, not everybody, but we have a better track record than most with retaining people. We have a very low turnover rate here.
Do you know what it reminds me of, Eric? And hopefully this will strike a little bit of a chord. You've got elements of an engineering firm. You've got elements of a consulting firm. I think of some IT consulting. You've got elements of research, but applied research. And some of that comes all together in some of the projects. So it does make for a different type of company deliverable and aspect, because you are, I'm sure, billing for projects and billing for time. And also you've got analytics that kind of run underneath that. Am I characterizing that accurately?
You've got a good description, a good summary of how we operate. I mean, on the engineering side, we're kind of the engineers' engineers. So most of our customers for engineering are engineering consultants themselves, where there's some specialization. And something I didn't really necessarily touch on before was that we're quite good at finding niche areas where we see that there's some expertise needed, and we dive in and we tend to do a deep dive and get very good at that particular niche, and we get repeat customers from that, and that's worked very, very well for us. So I mean, just to give you an example, we're very strong in metallurgy and do a lot of work for engineering firms on the metallurgical side. Well, we developed that strength over a long period of time. We were doing a lot of metallurgy for Pointe-la-Prairie, and we continue to do that to this day. But when it was being built, the shipbuilding program, we did a lot of metallurgy work on. Any of the power plants like Baldoon, we did metallurgy work on. And pipelines, when the gas pipeline went through, a lot of metallurgy work. The LNG terminal. So all these mega projects we've done work on, but that's built up our skill set so that that we have that on a day-to-day basis for engineering firms. Right now, we're doing a lot of work for offshore oil and metallurgy, and so we find these niche areas where people have needs, and then we widen our scope out enough so that we can have a sustainable business around it.
So how has the pandemic impacted the work that you're doing?
So it had several phases, I guess, almost. Initially, we followed the guidelines and reduced. We were considered an essential service because of our food testing and water testing and other things. So we reduced staff. We sent them home. We didn't lay them off to what we thought was the lowest level of staffing we could have for maintaining our services. So that was about 40% of our staff, with maybe 10% of them working from home. The administration people was relatively easy to work from home. That went on for a couple of weeks, but our work level really only dropped to about 60%. And then after a month or so, it started to climb, and we had to start recalling people. And by early April, we had recalled everyone. I guess it was into mid-April. We recalled all our employees back to the workplace with all the COVID measures that were necessary. We saw our research activity drop off. I think customers were uncertain about the future, and that was an area they cut back in. That's since rebounded. And we had a number of inquiries related to the pandemic. Can you make hand sanitizer? Can you test for COVID? These types of things. And we took a deliberate strategy to stick to our strategy. We said, okay, we're not pandemic people. We'll help where we can. So an example for that is it was easy for us to test hand sanitizer. We test for alcohol content. We that was an easy kind of inner wheelhouse type of thing. But we didn't get too far off track. We offered help to our government to say, hey, we have some supplies and some labs and some people. If there's an emergency, we'll help you. But we stuck to our knitting, and I think that's going to pay off for us in the long run, because we've progressed our strategy, progressed our equipment. So now that we're kind of in what I hope is the last to normal phase, and our business is running about 90%, so it's a little soft, but I'm not too disappointed in that because I recognize many businesses are in worse conditions. So we're about 90% of where we'd like to be with our business level. And so we're taking that little bit of extra breathing space to work on updating quality, getting new procedures in place and new methods developed and updating a couple of our labs. During the middle of the pandemic in June, we had a flood that wiped out 10,000 square feet of lab space. So we're still recovering from that. Next month, we're hoping to finally move back into the rebuilt labs and so on. So there was an initial real downturn, a soft rebound through the summer, and now we're at about 90% of
that's good news.
Yes, we're pleased with it.
I have one more question about RPC before we talk about productivity. How do you decide to get into a new line of business? Hmm. You know,
that's a very
big decision.
Yes, it is a big decision. Most of it is, first of all, do we belong there? Is there a need? Does it fit in our wheelhouse? And then the second part of it, is there some kind of sustainable capability here where we don't get government funding, so we for operational purposes anyway, we do qualify for some equipment and so on. But so we have to look at, will this be sustainable in the long run? That's not the only decision, but it's a big factor. And because part of our effort is a public good, and we will get into some testing because we know there's a need for it, even if it's not a profitable service line. So we evaluate it in that way. Normally, if it's a type of test, it's like, do we have existing equipment? Is it something that's an easy add-on to using an instrument that we already have in-house? Or is this a whole new instrument and an area that we need to get into? Those are the types of things that play into the decision. And increasingly, the facility is important. So in Fredericton, we're busting at the seams, and we're short of space. But the type of space is starting to get dictated as well, based on inquiries. So to give you an example of that. When you're dealing with biocontainment things, you need special facilities with cove floorings and washdown areas and negative pressure rooms and positive pressure rooms and things that your HVAC and your physical structure have to be designed to handle. And we have an eye, maybe we'll talk about this before time's up, but we have an eye to the Arctic. We think that's Canada's next generation Fort McMurray, in my opinion, and so when you get into testing in the Arctic, you're looking at low level detection, and you need rooms that have very limited background contamination possibilities, and so as we get to opportunity to add to our structure here, we're going to be taking those things into consideration when we decide what type of services we're going to be offering.
So, Eric, I hope we can get back to that Arctic discussion if we don't run out of time, because that sounds interesting. But RPC does stand for Research and Productivity Council. So when I think of Eric Cook, I think of you as a bit of a productivity guy. I think you're also someone who likes to think about innovation in interesting ways. So I want to dive into that for the second part of our discussion. I've always thought RPC's a little secret haven of innovation with this outstanding and incredible talent. So I'm so glad we're able to tell more of our listeners about the great work that's going on there. So talk about productivity, and let's really boil it down to some simple discussions around what is it and why is it so darn important right now in our economy and to be talking and doing something about our productivity.
Yeah, so I mean, productivity goes, the reason it's important, it goes straight to our quality of life. If we're not a productive economy, the things that we like to have for a quality of life, whether it be healthcare or other services, good roads, those things, they're not possible. We need to be a productive economy to have those things that we want. And to dive in, you know, a pure definition is really, the value of outputs divided by the value of the inputs. I mean, that's a way of looking at it. And Canada, in New Brunswick for the most part, has had a pretty good go of that over the years because we have abundant natural resources, and we've had pretty abundant low cost labor. And as we know, that's changing. And add into that another factor, we've enjoyed a advantageous U.S. exchange, our biggest trading partner. And those factors have not put the pressure on productivity that you might expect in the economy. So all those things are changing. And now we are hearing about looming labor shortages. The pandemic highlighted how dependent we are on things like temporary foreign workers. There's a global economy, there's price pressure. We've seen what's happened to the price of paper over the years. Things have changed. And it's no longer acceptable for a company to compete and be competitive on low-cost labor. We know that's just not a sustainable competitive advantage. I would argue, nor is it to count on low-cost energy or abundant, easy-to-access natural resources. All these factors point to the need to improve productivity. And I think it's time for us to all get a wake-up call that productivity becomes important. And I think companies that are going to thrive in the next phase here will be those that make a commitment to be a productive company.
So how do I get started in this space? How do I start to imagine whether or not I'm running an agricultural business or I'm running a shop on Main Street, and perhaps I need to be thinking about how I am doing my customer service delivery of products and goods? It starts with a mindset change around productivity, and that's not easy.
You're absolutely right. You need that mindset change and make a commitment that this is going to be part of my business strategy. I'm going to be prepared to invest in productivity. And that's a bit of a change. The people will invest in new product development. They'll invest in marketing and sales. Fewer people invest in productivity. So the first step is a mindset change. And then I think the next step is a business assessment and mapping. And there's been over the years, when it comes to particularly manufacturing, there's always like a hot trend. You know, years ago it was quality assurance. Then you see Lean or Six Sigma. Currently it's automation and AI and machine learning. All those things could be possible solutions for you, but you need to do an assessment and identify which technology, process you need to make improvements on that'll get you the best ROI, and start, the old adage, how you eat an elephant, one bite at a time. Start taking bites on the things that give you the best ROI, and that'll begin to change your culture and help your company become more profitable and competitive. So,
how important is it to the New Brunswick economy right now that we focus on productivity coming out, continuing to work through the pandemic? We're not coming out of it yet, continuing to work through it.
Well, I think it's essential. And I mentioned the temporary foreign worker challenge during the pandemic. And those are jobs that our local residents no longer want to perform. And they're prime candidates in many cases for technology, possibly automation in some cases, and other productivity improvements. But beyond the pandemic, we know because of demographics and the baby boomers and so on that there's going to be a labor shortage. And right now we're in a period where we've enjoyed abundant labor. It's sort of been an employer's market. And when the tables turn, and they're beginning to turn now, we know of examples of where this is the case. People have jobs that they can't fill, and that's a challenge. So I think employers need to consider how they run their business with fewer jobs, not less labor intensive, but also jobs that people want to do and they're interested in. And those jobs are going to be, you know, more value add jobs where you might be, instead of filling fish, you're running a robot that, and a vision system that does it, that type of thing. I think that's going to be essential to make that transition.
So when I think of productivity, Eric, I often think that the large employers in the province, we've talked about one or two of them already here today, but they can invest in automation and AI and machine learning and data analytics that helps them to understand all of that. But how do we help small and medium-sized businesses understand that these tools are accessible, that the price of technology is going down, and that there are companies like RPC and others that can come in and understand and do those sorts of business assessments? How do we help that transition?
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think that's one of the most promising things about the productivity movement right now. I mean, things like robots are not new. They've been around, you know, since the 50s and 60s. But they were applied in the highest value type of manufacturing, mostly the automotive sector. But as you've suggested, this technology has become far more affordable. And another important factor is far more user-friendly. I mean, years ago, if you were programming a robot, somewhere in your organization, you needed a room full of C++ programmers to program it. That's no longer the case. Most of the programming that takes place is done by an engineer who's not a programmer. So to give you an example of what's happened, we're one of the applications that we're using technology in is we've applied several cobots, which is a collaborative robot. And a collaborative robot can work collaboratively with people. So it has sensors so that if it gets close to a person, it knows to slow down and so on. This really enhances the number of applications because there's certain things humans do that robots will probably, well, at least for the near term, not be ever good at. And the human can do those very specialized functions, and the robot can do the more mundane.
Mundane.
Yeah. So that, I think cobots, I think the ones we're using are something like $60,000 right now. I mean, that's something years ago you would imagine being an order of magnitude more expensive. And to your point about it being more accessible for SMEs, so we've done several one-off projects. So when you're talking automation, you don't need to visualize the automotive factory any longer. We've done projects in the forestry sector. That's a one-off. We'll probably never build another one like it again because they only need one. We've just done a project outside of St. John for a person that has a business that he runs with his family, and we've developed a custom machine to manufacture a component for him. That was affordable for him, and this is quite a change. So sometimes when something comes on the scene, new technology, like I say, like robots. Years ago, you're younger than me, so maybe you don't remember this, but I can remember when they said robots were going to be bringing you your coffee in the morning and all these crazy things. Well, that didn't happen. It was cost prohibitive. Well, things have come down in price, and they're easier to use. And a great example of that, a technology that's kind of in this realm, is 3D printers.
Perfect example.
Yeah, years ago, we actually had one of the very first so-called 3D printers. It was called stereolithography at that time, up at UDM. It was $1 million machine, but it could do basically what a 3D printer can do today. Well, at $1 million, it was pretty limited in its applications. But now you get 3D printers down to be $3,000 to $5,000, depending on the features you want and the accuracy and all that. And the world of opportunity opens up. So as prices drop and costs drop, it opens up more applications. And that is what we're really seeing happening in the world of automation right at the moment.
And it comes down to the business case.
It does. What's the ROI is the important part. And we are doing technology assessments for companies now, collaborating with the COA who subsidize those eligible clients. And we're seeing ROIs in some cases under 2 years. Which is quite attractive. If you're talking about an investment with a little bit of risk and a few unknown factors and the ROI of 7 or 8 years out, it's a little bit more difficult to make that decision. But if you're going to have a good idea and start realizing return on investment under 2 years, that's a less risky decision to make. So,
and I guess the other thing, Eric, maybe you could comment on, something that I've learned since I've been involved in Tech Impact and been involved with the New Brunswick Innovation Foundation, is there are all of these partners who collaborate to work on different types of funding programs, how to do grant applications, how to work with MyTax, for example, to get access to students. There is this other world out there that is trying to conspire to help small and medium-sized businesses get access to talent that maybe some of this business community doesn't understand how to get access to that. Is that a fair comment?
I think it's a fair comment, and to be fair to the businesses, it's a tough job keeping your business going every day, getting your products out the door, collecting the bills, making sales, and frankly, it's difficult for them to keep up to the changing programs.
Absolutely.
Go on. So I do respect that, but certainly that's part of our role, is to help navigate some of those waters. We have good relationships with funding partners like MBIF and like ACOA and like IRAP, and we help navigate those waters a little bit. It's not exactly our business model, but it becomes part of our value proposition when we're helping clients. So yeah, I think these programs help businesses de-risk some of these investments in technology, and the new Tech Impact Digital Boost program is another good one. It helps de-risk the project, and so there is programs. Something else you mentioned that I think is really important is access to students. We really encourage this. I think there's so many benefits when students are out on a co-op or a graduate program, because the business sees the value they bring. It helps people like RPC, who are service providers, because we have somebody who speaks our language on the client side. It helps the students to realize, hey, there's employers here in New Brunswick that have opportunities that use my skill sets. And I think that's so important to get students out into the business community. There's multiple benefits with that.
And experiential learning is so important, and there are definitely avenues to explore to get support to bring more students in place. So I can't support you enough on that. I want to end on some of your own thought leadership. I pay attention to what you're writing, Eric, and you've recently written something about the sixth wave of innovation. And, that talks about the use of technology, operating things remotely, new computing capability, automation and robotics, and how do we, increase this wave of innovation. But what's interesting is that you think it's important to achieve a sustainable planet. So the scientist is talking about a sustainable planet a little bit here. Tell us about why you collaborated on that piece, why writing that was important, and what you were trying to accomplish by putting that thought leadership out into the marketplace.
Yeah, so thank you for recognizing that. This came out in April, that particular article on the sixth wave. And my colleague, Lori Schramm, who's the former CEO of Saskatchewan Research Council, my sister organization in Saskatchewan, we worked on it together. And at the time, it was the early dark days of the pandemic. And we were trying to think differently. We were trying to think about what opportunities this might provoke, because it's very easy to think of all the negative impacts that the pandemic was going to have. And we are subscribers of these Kondratiev waves of innovation. Kondratiev is a Russian economist, his work was elaborated on by Schumpeter in the U.S. later on. But they historically looked at innovation and determined that it happens in waves. And it usually has triggers at the top of the wave and at the bottom of the wave that are major world events like a depression or a war. These are things that trigger the wave to move in a different direction. And we were speculating that we're nearing the end of the fifth wave and entering the sixth wave, and that the inflection points could be the 1-2 punch of the 2008 economic meltdown and the 2019-2021 pandemic. Very similar to back in 1918, the Spanish flu, followed by the depression in 1929. And there's no doubt about it. Innovation happens when there's an intervention, some crises or some needs. I mean, we touched on it a bit earlier. If there's a labor shortage, you have no choice but to move from depending on low-cost labor. You have to adopt technology or you're going to be out of business. And so we think that this was going to create some intervention. Some people are going to have to change the way they're doing business. So we speculated a bit, and certainly I think the Industry 4.0, which is really all these things we're talking about, the automation, vision systems, the big data, all these types of things, integrated system, I think we're starting to see that emerge. I mean, really only history dictates that. We think there's a couple of other trends in there that could be possible. I think the clean tech movement that's been talked about for years is, I think we're here now. I think we're going to have to be starting to change our economy and how we do things and think about our design of products and the use of materials. And we think that's a big part towards a sustainable planet. And I also think, as you'll note from the paper, that I think biotech is going to be a huge part, possibly a seventh wave that's going to emerge later on. And we're seeing that. We're seeing how COVID and the vaccine development, how important that is. And if you dig into the vaccine, it's not your traditional vaccine. It's sending DNA instructions into your body. This is new ground. And I was familiar with this through my work with Genome Canada board, but we thought it was years away from the general public accepting it. Now we have people lining up to accept it. And this is an exciting area because they're talking about using similar technology for some treating some forms of cancer and other diseases. This is one of the positive things coming out of the pandemic, is this is going to probably move this technology ahead maybe as much as a generation. And I think that's good news for Atlantic Canada, because we're a natural resource-based economy, you know, forestry, farming, the oceans, all these things have influenced our economy, and all of them have linkages to biotech. And so that's an area that RPC is investing in heavily going forward. We see it as a wave of the future. And it links into clean tech, energy, clean food, water, all these areas that are essential to us surviving on this planet.
Would you have thought a year ago, Eric, we would have been talking about local supply chain, local food production at the intensity that we are compared to what we were versus a global economy, a global food chain? I mean, there's been a lot that has been upended. That's part of what you wrote about.
Yes. Yeah. To be honest, I hoped for it, but I didn't think it would happen the way it's unfolding. And our RPC's value proposition is the total value proposition: price, delivery, and quality. And I felt that globalization, one of the sort of pitfalls of globalization, is it really got focused on price. And if it took 8 months for something to get on a container ship coming from Asia, we're going to deal with that because it's a low price. Or you know, think about the dollar store. I use this example all the time. You go into the dollar store and you buy a spatula, and it might only last you a couple of months before it breaks. And who knows, if you're unfortunate, there could be some contaminant substances flaking off of it, versus a nice stainless steel food grade spatula made by Paderno and PEI that might cost five times as much. I think values are going to start to change. You're going to think about the garbage you're generating. You're going to think about, you know, the how long a product lasts, the local supply. Not everything, but I think it is going to make an impact on people. And that's good news for organizations like RPC that don't just compete on price. Of course, you want to be competitive, but our ideal customer gives value to quality and delivery as well. And I think that's good news for our economy.
So when you were thinking about these ideas, just to finish off, you know, do you feel like we're going through a digital transformation, an economic transformation? And we spend so much time talking about, you know, digital technology and automation and all that it can enable. I feel we're on the cusp of it. I feel it's happened. Do you have that sense as well?
Yeah, so I would agree with you. I mean, just straightforward things like cloud computing, and we could run our business from a home because we were set up with serving from the cloud with our essential business software and systems. And that was a fairly recent transformation that we went through here, but we were thankful for it. I would agree with you. I think we're just people are going to have their eyes open and recognize how important it is to make these transformations. And as we were discussing a bit earlier, when they see that it is affordable, it is possible for small businesses. It's not just for the General Motors of the world. It's small businesses can benefit from these technologies.
I want to end on the Arctic. So why are you so hot, pardon the pun, on the Arctic? And why do you see that as being such an opportunity?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is, as I had my eyes opened about 3 years ago, I had the very good fortune to travel to Cambridge Bay, which is inside the Arctic Circle, and see the brand new Canadian High Arctic Research Station. This is a $260 million research station built in a town of 1,600 people. Imagine that impact. Pick a New Brunswick town with 1,600 people and build a $260 million research center there. And when I was up there, I quickly realized, well, first of all, they have enormous resources, mining and energy, but they also have enormous needs. They're totally dependent on diesel generated electricity. Well, that's just a thing of the past. They've got to move off of that. So I think much of what we're going to see needed to develop the Arctic is what we need to do to get to a low carbon sustainable economy. So I think there's lessons to be learned up there. It's almost like outer space where you're pushing to the limits, and you'll be able to use your learnings to benefit from our everyday life. I think it's untouched. I think Atlantic Canada has had many things not go our way. I mean, you look at Canada's economy as a whole, and the government for many years put tons of effort into developing the auto sector, which really only benefited Ontario. You know, they had complete trade departments set up to negotiate trade agreements, all kinds of funding and so on, or the aerospace sector in Quebec, or, you know, Alberta's oil economy for quite some time thrived. Atlantic Canada hasn't had one of those big engines. I think, frankly, Atlantic Canada could move into the Arctic as far as developing technology and helping to unlock some of the potential up there.
I think that's really fun and a great way to end. Well, Eric, look, I appreciate all that you're doing here in New Brunswick to help us be all that we can be. I think you run a gem of an organization at RPC, and I'm looking forward to spending more time talking about innovation in 2021 with you.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for having me. Thank you for the work you're doing to highlight New Brunswick entities and capabilities. I think we have the right stuff here. We just need to get our mojo going in the right direction, working together.
I couldn't agree more. We covered a lot of ground today, and I can't thank Eric enough for joining us. We talked about his roots in PEI, about RPC and the work that they do, what is productivity and its importance in our evolving economy, and then we learned more about his perspective on the sixth wave of innovation. We'll have a link to that paper that Eric co-authored in the blog in the show notes. Eric is a thought leader, and I've had the pleasure to work with Eric on some projects, and he brings an innovative and collaborative mindset to everything that he does. He's curious, he asks questions, and provides great counsel and advice. So it was wonderful to have his perspective and thought leadership today on the show. I hope you check out more on RPC at rpc.ca. The breadth of their services and deep expertise will astound you. They are here to bring innovative ideas to life, and we need that if we're going to keep growing our economy. Thanks again for joining us, everybody. We're grateful that you do. Talk soon.
Tech Talks is brought to you by Tech Impact. Learn more at techimpact.it. The podcast is hosted by Tech Impact CEO, Kathy Simpson. It's produced by me, Matt George. It's engineered by the great Zachary Pelche and is part of the Unsettled Media Podcast Network.